Why Love Matters. This is probably a more dangerous, pitfall-struck sermon topic than even politics or, God help me, religion. There are just so many problems involved in talking about love. One of the reasons of the many is that it is one of those ineffable experiences that is profoundly real, yet remains ineffable. It remains unable to be expressed in clear and logical words. There may be a logic to love. There may be scientific explanations. There may be reasons of evolutionary biology for love. And that kind of leaves us cold on Valentine's Day. When we talk about love, most of the time we tend to be thinking in certain kinds of categories. It's kind of inevitable. I had a friend and a professor who was one of the great Christian theologians, a recognized expert on the field. And he said, you know, whenever anybody says the word God, I think of this old white guy with a white beard and a toga sitting on a throne. I know I'm not supposed to, and I know that isn't what I mean, but that's the picture in my head. When we say the word love, our default position usually is about eros and romance. The Greeks were wise enough to try to break it down into three larger or smaller categories. Eros, romantic love being one, philae, which is attraction, being another, such as Philadelphia, the love of the Delphic oracle, not necessarily the city. Other one, and the one that you're familiar from watching all of the evangelical TV preachers that I know you all do, is agape. And that's the unconditional love that is the acceptance of another human being. Well, the great 20th century linguistic philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein, in a book unpublished before his death, The Philosophical Investigations, had some very important words that I think are applicable. He said, he asked, what does soccer have to do with tic-tac-toe? What makes them both games? And his answer was, don't think, look. What puts together, what is the connection between agape, the unconditional love of another human being for whom you may have romantic feelings, for whom you may have affection, or if it's a teenage child, you might cordially detest at certain moments, but you still have that greater sense of agape, of love, of acceptance. And it seems to me that the connection amongst agape and philae and eros is connection. They are all things that connect us in one way, body, soul, life, interest, attention to one another. It's very easy, and looking for cheap laughs, which occasionally I've been known to do, to make the sermon really about sex and just to riff on all of the silliness that we have in sex, and sexuality are certainly an important part of love. It's kind of how most of us, maybe even all of us, got here. We know that that is not what makes us different from other animals. We know that birds do it, bees do it, educated fleas do it. There's not an awful lot of either virtue or vice in the simple impulse to do it. It's an important part of what has created evolution. Amoebas don't do it, but just about every animal life form above an amoeba exchanges genetic information in order to make some kind of progress, in order to be faster or smarter or more sensitive to the light, better able to take care of ourselves, and most importantly, to take care of others and our world. There's a lot of stuff that gets written about the science of romance and of love, of all of the pheromones that attract us to one another,
of how women are attracted to men with deep voices because that bespeaks an outrageous level of testosterone, of how wide shoulders for men and wide hips for women are all of these reproductive strategies. And reproductive strategies are certainly important for getting here, for being here, and for seeing that the race of humanity continues to be here. But the category of love is so much greater and richer and deeper, with so much more texture than simple eros, romance, and the meeting and mating game of all of the smells and the spells that we use in order, for the sociobiologist called, to disseminate, word is important, to disseminate our genes and to find immortality through reproduction. Love is more about either recreation or recreation of the species. It really is about connecting to each other, to our world, and to our own best selves. When we look at human behavior and at animal behavior, it is clear that there are some things that are deeply ingrained in us and in the genetic code. The idea to give, to protect, to serve something greater than ourselves. Love at its finest, not simply to be confused with lust, but love, lust is the consumption of another for one's own pleasure. Love is a connecting of person to person. It can be philosophical, it can be physical, it can be affectional. It's a connection that goes beyond the simple issues of biology, but it is rooted in our need not to be alone, not to be alone in time, not to be alone in space, but to have connections forwards to a future and back from whence we came, to have connections with each other that sustain us and enrich us and convince us, and this is a hard jump to make, but convince us through experience, not simply through philosophy or reasoning, that the great impulse and insight of love is stunning. It is, I am not the most important creature in the universe. What an incredible relief. What an incredible leap from desires. What an incredible relief from selfishness, because sometimes we think that selfishness is the most rational of ways to be. But watch in the animal kingdom, watch in the human kingdom, watch a mother bird put herself between her young and a predator and put her life at risk through instinct. Watch a human mother do the same, or a human father. Look at the behavior of human beings in times of crisis and the extraordinary instinctual behaviors we have of generosity, of self-sacrifice. We all know stories about how in war a soldier, without thinking, used to be men but now women, would throw themselves on a grenade, get in between their friends, the people whom they fight for and fight with and live, and they would sacrifice themselves without thinking about it, like that mother bird or like that father bird, that there is something that is greater than the immediate interests of my desires. I don't know how to separate selfishness from generosity. I really don't. And you can play mind games and get tremendously confused about things like that. If there are any parents here, you will probably know, and if there are any children here, who don't have parents, I'm sorry, who don't have children, you should know this, and you will know it someday, and that is almost every parent would rather have the cold, the flu, the broken leg, the wound, the injury, the heartbreak, instead of their child. That's love. That's more than romantic love. That's love. That's connection. That's caring about someone and something else more than our immediate gratification. Now, where it gets confusing is, yeah, I want to do that because it'll make me feel better to feel miserable and have the person I love feel less miserable. That's making me feel better, so do I have to feel guilty that I'm actually sacrificing and I feel good about it? Don't go crazy. It's much simpler than that. As I watch and help and occasionally have to bend, spindle, fold, and mutilate Helene's leg to get rid of the adhesions, I wish it were me. I wish it were me. Do I wish that for her sake? Yes. Do I wish it for my sake so I didn't have to look at her pain? Yes. Is there anything wrong with that confusion? I don't think so. It's the way that I feel about her, that I feel about our children, about our grandchildren. It is a sense of connection beyond our immediate and most obvious and most lonely and most solipsistic and isolated skin sack of self that connects us to the world. And does it have to be our biological children? Of course not. Adoption creates exactly the same bonds. Partnership creates the same bonds. Dare I say that we create many of the same bonds with pets, that endless numbers of people have run into burning houses and apartments to put their lives at risk, to lose their lives, to save a pet, because our hearts cannot live in total isolation just within our bodies. They have to reach out and connect to another or to others, or connect to the world. There are people who put their lives at risk for the ecology, for the mountains, for the valleys, for the seas, who will go out and take risks because they are connected to a greater sense of purpose. That is love. It can't be caught simply in eros or philae or agape. It is the ultimate connection. We also can get into other kinds of distractions about what we feel and what we should feel and what we think and what we should think about love. The world has always experimented with sex and with love, and there has not always been a great deal of candor either amongst people or in the internal dialogue that we have with ourselves. I can remember very well being a very young clergyman in 1970 at my first congregation, and I had two young parents come to me and say, you know, I just feel terrible. My 12-year-old daughter is having sex. That was a little more unusual then. My 12-year-old daughter is having sex, and I really feel bad because I feel bad. You got that? They weren't in a position to be in touch with what their feelings were. They wanted to deny their feelings because their heads told them, according to the social ethos of the moment, it's all good, it's all wonderful, groovy, totally, whatever, dude. Well, we didn't have dude then, but groovy, totally. And they felt bad about feeling bad. They couldn't be in touch with the prime issue, which is we've got lots of complex issues about sex, about mating, about pairing up, about all of these things, and we deny its reality at our peril. Now, how far you take your feelings is a different issue, but we deny its reality at our peril. I am not telling tales out of school because my very good friend, Rob Eller Isaacs, wrote in this month's Church of the Larger Fellowship about how he came to spiritual discipline and his Tai Chi routine that he has come up with. And he said it came out of an experience of rage when his girlfriend dumped him, betrayed him for his best friend. And back in the 60s in Berkeley, that didn't seem to be a cliche. That seemed like, well, I'm not really supposed to be mad about this. I'm not supposed to feel possessive because, you know, like I'm me and like you're you, and when we're, you know. And it came as a shock to him that he had feelings that, my God, even his parents could have related to. That all of the old paradigms had not been broken and shattered, because there are some things deep within our code about protecting and defending and being paired and partnered with one another. Is it neurotic? Nice judgment. Maybe yes, maybe no. Is it in the coding that got us here? Yes. Is that good? Is that bad? I don't judge it any more than I judge gravity. But we deny it at our peril. Whether we're talking about our parents or ourselves or our children, there are lots of primal feelings that are going on. And one of the things that makes it so difficult, one of the many things that makes it so difficult not to talk nonsense about this, is just how complex it is. We have something called civilization. The idea of it, to some extent, is to civilize us, is to get us past our animal instincts so that we don't just act on every stupid, violent, sexual, selfish impulse that may come flying in between our ears. That's a good part about civilization. But the bad part about civilization is that it can also take us away from our instincts. Our instincts to protect. Our instincts to sacrifice. The mother bird doesn't have a conversation with herself about, well, you know, that eagle's awful big and it's almost spring and time to go to North Dakota, and I'm kind of ready to leave Florida anyway, so I can always lay more eggs. So I think I'll just take off now. That internal moral dialogue doesn't happen. But civilization fools us sometimes into believing that we can have that conversation. That I can say, you know, I know college is important, but I really want that flat screen TV. You know, I know that there's important political work to be done out there in the world, but, you know, $100 could get me 3 or 4 drinks at Starbucks. I mean, why should I give them to a candidate? I know that the mountains are being brought low, the valleys are being filled in, and the sea is being polluted, but, you know, that flat screen TV again, it just is calling to me, and 50 inches, which seemed so big only 6 months ago, I can get 73, and the valleys won't get filled in much faster, the seas won't get polluted much more, it'll be okay. Civilization sometimes takes us away from the good instincts, the generous instincts, the instincts that connect us to our better angels, to our deepest selves, to the impulse to actually be a participant in the creation of the next generation. We've got adopted kids in our family, and I can tell you, it doesn't make any difference. Not just in the head, but immediately. We had a situation, and some of you know this story, where my wife had an uncle who was a very scarred and flawed human being. He had had more than the unusual and awful experiences during World War II and the Holocaust and in the work camps, and he was deeply flawed. He was not what you would call the poster child for colorblind liberalism. And when his daughter adopted a child, a mixed race child, everybody was afraid to kind of tell him. You know, well, you know, you'll meet him. And so when Isaiah was born, and there was the naming ceremony that the family was having, and Uncle was going to come up from San Diego and see his only grandchild, this man in his middle late 80s, his only grandchild, who was black and beautiful, everybody held their breath because they didn't know how Uncle would react. Would he say an expletive? Would he turn away? Would he say to his daughter, "What were you thinking?" He took one look at Isaiah, his eyes filled with tears, and he threw his arms around Isaiah and held him against his chest and wept, because that was instantly, without pheromones, without chemistry, without a genetic connection, that was his grandchild. And became, when I say, the light of his life for his remaining years, it didn't transform him completely as a human being, but it was the light of his life. All the other lights had gone out. And Isaiah was a light. And when he talked of him, and when he looked at his picture, and when he showed his picture, none of the expected garbage and baggage was present. Here was a man closer, much closer to the end than the beginning, with his only grandchild that was his link to a tomorrow that he would not see. And it was the only thing that brought light to his eyes. We make our connections. We make them with Eros, we make them with Philae, and we make them, most importantly, the largest category of agape. And that is the acceptance of each other, of a world, of our place, our limited place in time, and how, by love, we do light a light. By lighting this chalice, we remind ourselves of the light of love, the light of the enlightenment of reason, and the human warmth that love creates when we make it, when we give it, when we share it. Love is not about belief. It's not simply science or pheromones. It isn't just frilly poetry. It is the way that we connect our lives through space and time to the source of life in each other.